Our Lady of Grace homilies are brought to you by a generous parishioner who encourages you to join in prayer for mission churches worldwide. Explore the Frontiers of Faith podcast for further insights into these missions.
A reading from the Holy Gospel according to John. On the first day of the week, Mary of Magdala came to the tomb early in the morning while it was still dark and saw the stone removed from the tomb. So she ran and went to Simon Peter and to the other disciple whom Jesus loved and told them, "They have taken the Lord from the tomb, and we do not know where they put him." So Peter and the other disciple went out and came to the tomb. They both ran, but the other disciple ran faster than Peter and arrived at the tomb first. He bent down and saw the burial cloths there, but did not go in. When Simon Peter arrived after him, he went into the tomb and saw the burial cloths there and the cloth that had covered his head, not with the burial cloths, but rolled up in a separate place. Then the other disciple also went in, the one who had arrived at the tomb first, and he saw and believed, for they did not yet understand the scripture that he had to rise from the dead. The Gospel of the Lord. My friends, happy Easter. My name is Father Cody Owens, and I'm actually technically not a priest here at this parish, so if you're visiting, me too. I live here, but I am right now a chaplain at Guerin Catholic High School. Welcome all the same. Very happy to have you. It is my distinct pleasure, chaplain though I am, to be able to celebrate Easter Mass with you today. This is a season of profound joy, of light shining where darkness had been, of a long heralded victory amidst a season of losses, of selves suddenly remembering who they are and what they are for. So, good. I hope you experience all of that. But can I tell you something? It's a paternal fear, a fatherly fear that I have. It gnaws at me in my head at night as I think about the people entrusted to my care that God will ask me about one day. I worry that perhaps you'll come to Mass today. You'll get all dressed up and you will get punched in the face with pastels. And then you will go home and you'll make your ham and you'll call grandma and you'll watch some basketball. And then you'll start thinking about tomorrow. And oh no, then all of this will go away and it'll be done. And I'm afraid of that. I'm afraid of that for you. When I say that, I'm not saying I'm afraid of that because, like, I need job security or something like that. I need you to care so that I can keep getting the paycheck. Don't care about that. Not worried about it. What I care about, most important, is your eyes opened. This is the idea of the resurrection, one that the apostles struggled with a little bit, even in the early morning hour. To that end, I'd like to share with you a little bit of my own prayer from this week in hopes that some of it might be a little contagious and might shine a little bit of light into your own lives in those places that might be precariously placed so as to be washed away when you leave the church. We don't want that. So reflect with me. Bishop Eric Varden reflected that if we stay imprisoned in our merely experiential notions, we'll miss the point because we'll reduce God to our story instead of growing into his. Monsignor Luigi Giussani once famously stated, "The real protagonist of history is the beggar. Christ, who begs for man's heart and man's heart that begs for Christ." Combine these quotations and sit on them for a while, and you'll come to a particular conclusion. Varden says, we run the risk of reducing God to our story instead of growing into his. Giussani, that the real protagonist is Christ himself. Our conclusion then for Easter is this, that this all around us, not just in the church, but as you were driving on 37 or through the back roads in Noblesville, all of it is God's story. He is the protagonist. The main action, the things that matter, are happening to him. He is driving the plot. His decisions, his desires, his actions are the ones that make the story move. The way we get involved into it, the reason it matters to us is that he, the protagonist, desires us. He desires you. We step into the action and the main thread of life when we choose to allow our desires to be for him. We all of us have a deep, unshakable intuition, which we usually dismiss and sometimes forget. But occasionally, on days like today, our intuition escapes to remind us of what we suspect secretly. We suspect that life can't just be about us and our stuff. It has to be about more. There must be more on the line than my high school career. This audit I'm experiencing, while relatively important, can't be the meaning of life. My experience of dullness, of traffic, of broken business and broken relationships, of too many responsibilities, and of dreams put off for another day. My experience of suffering and of death can't be the main story. What's the meaning of life? Where did it all come from? Where's it all going? Today we remember that it started when all things started. After being created good, our first parents fell from grace, tragically and aggressively. But they were not erased from the story. The heart of the protagonist yearned for them, and so they held their place. But the story changed its timbre. An Arabic commentary on the story of the fall puts some words to God's heart. It imagines him saying, "Adam, do not be distressed that you must, on account of this sentence, depart from paradise. I will bring you back to your inheritance. See how I have loved you. On your account, I have cursed the earth, but you I have spared from curses. Since you have transgressed, do leave, but do not be distressed. For when time has been fulfilled, I will send my son, and by my son, your salvation will be wrought." And this is exactly what happened to Adam and to all of us. When the son came, the story moved. This was what it was all about. Millennia of preparation had led to this main climax, except that when the son came, he was largely unrecognized, unknown, because largely the world had forgotten this story, had perhaps mistaken themselves as the protagonist, and so were caught up with the daily business. From Sabbath to Sabbath, the Jewish people maintained their livelihoods and their families. They prayed their prayers and kept their traditions. But they forgot all the while they were God's chosen people, they were God's chosen people. And so when Christ came into the world, he came anonymously. Let me add one more wrinkle to this part of the story for you. When he came into the world, he came anonymously. You're like, "Father, tell me something I don't know. Seen the Ten Commandments, watched the Passion of the Christ. I've been Catholic my whole life. I know this stuff." Good for you. I teach in a Catholic school, A-. Let me add another layer. When I say he came anonymously, when I say he was unrecognized, I don't just mean by us. The demonic mind, equally in the dark, was reveling in a different set of thoughts. Satan had seen this Christ, this new prophet, arise as he had seen many before. And he had been battling against him according to the resources allowed him. He had attacked him with seductions and temptations. He had tried to frighten him, to flatter him, and to discourage him. He had stirred up his servants against him. But he could gain no foothold. The man had not only dodged every dart and sidestepped every carefully laid trap, but he had shown a strange power of undoing Satan's rule. Yet worse, he had taught and empowered others to do the same. The whole matter had been perplexing and infuriating, yet the devil knew he had the final card. Whatever the man might say or do, in the end, he was a son of Adam, a mortal under the same curse of death. And sooner or later, sooner if it could be managed, he would die. He would then be gathered under Satan's dominion with all the miserable human fellows and share the fate of a fallen and rebel race. And now at last Satan had cleverly succeeded, so he thought, in putting into effect the plan that had caught Jesus and killed him. The victory would be so much the sweeter for having been so long deflected and delayed. He sped to embrace this soul newly detached from its physical remains and was more than usually eager to feast upon the latest of his conquests, to enjoy that special moment when he could reveal himself as overlord and could relish the horror of his human slave. The only glimmer of satisfaction left to his twisted spirit. But the greed and gloating of the devil turned rapidly into something very different. He did indeed meet the new arrival. He did encounter the soul of the man he had connived to have killed. But something strange, entirely new to his experience, began to happen. The prisoner did not come sad and defeated, bound in chains of darkness and surrounded by the triumphant laughter of demons. Instead, he came wrapped in blinding, searing light, such as had never before blazed in that dark dungeon. He came forward upright and strong with authority and power, sending the demons shrieking in dismay and boldly advancing upon the Prince of Darkness. Now the mind of Satan was filled with fear and foreboding as the true identity of this mysterious figure broke upon him. And he saw too late that the trap he had so cleverly laid for his enemy had sprung upon himself. The idea that the divine Logos, the Word, might humbly unite himself to humanity had never entered the darkest corner of his proud mind. His cunning craftiness had been overthrown by God's seeming foolishness. By bringing a criminal's death upon the innocent Son of God, he had unwittingly opened death's door. Now the Lord of life himself was demanding from him the keys of death, was announcing the good news to all who had been chained by it, and was leading them out of the devil's dungeon into freedom and light. Christ harrowed hell and conquered death. Too often, the idea of death being conquered becomes a bit of rhetoric. It's a thing you say during Easter. Maybe you see it in a Hallmark card surrounded with eggs. But it is so, so real. It is a conquering that defines your life. As you move throughout your day, to the extent that you give it permission to take your heart captive, it will consume your thoughts. And as you approach the end of your life, as all of us will one day, you will reflect upon this conquering, and it will save you. This is why we celebrate a resurrection. And the celebration of the resurrection is ancient, so ancient that we have homilies from priests that predate dating and authorship. One priest, in an anonymous ancient homily from this day, says this: "Something strange is happening. There is a great silence on earth, a great silence and stillness. The whole earth keeps silence because the king is asleep. The earth trembled and is still because God has fallen asleep in the flesh, and he has raised up all who have slept ever since the world began. He's gone down to the dead to search for our first parent as for a lost sheep, greatly desiring to visit those who live in darkness and in the shadow of death. He has gone to free from sorrow the captives Adam and Eve, he who is both God and the son of Eve. The Lord approached them bearing the cross, the weapon that had won him the victory. At the sight of him, Adam, the first man he had created, struck his breast in terror and cried out to everyone, "My Lord be with you all." Christ answered him, "And with your spirit." He took him by the hand and raised him up, saying, "Awake, O sleeper, and rise from the dead, and Christ will give you light." The promise of God from the very beginning, from that moment after the fall when all seemed lost, was followed through. The satisfaction that man had longed for when he relied upon himself was given him as he learned to rely upon the hand of God, which he had spurned in his infancy. The protagonist moved the story along. And that's an Easter homily. But here's the thing, a thing I can't quite get out of my mouth. It's a part of every homily that I give, and I'm sorry if it sounds exhausting. Ugh. I'm not trying to give you a history lesson. I don't care about history. I studied it and I got a grade in it. Woo! Who cares? Because that grade isn't going to last. And if history isn't rooted in some sort of meaning, it just doesn't matter. At the beginning of all of this, I told you my fear that you're going to go out there and forget about what matters. But what is it that actually matters? If God is the protagonist, if this is actually his story, then everything matters. But perhaps for a different reason than you thought before you came into this church. Everything matters because God has created this world, because his heart longs for you. And if there's a thing in your life, then that thing is in God's life. To the extent that this world keeps turning, it turns because God has conquered death and allowed us yet another opportunity, another day, to be able to yield another part of our hearts over to him, to give him a little bit more of our time, to be able to surrender, not just a moment, but our whole selves, so that now every moment is God's moment. And the story that we live can become the main story. Remember today, as you have your Easter meal, that our task is not to try to fit God into our story. Rather, we are invited to be swept up into his. So your homework this Easter Sunday is to take some time during the rest of the day. Maybe you're watching something on TV or sitting down in the back patio. I haven't seen what the weather's going to be like yet. Maybe it's around your dinner table and maybe after a couple Irish coffees. I want you to reflect and share with one person, one way that you will surrender a part of your life over to the story of God. This is the way that we become integrated into this great victory. This is the way that we celebrate Easter, this season of profound joy, light shining where darkness had been, long heralded victory amidst a season of losses, selves suddenly remembering who they are and what they're for. My friends, today, Christ has won victory over death. And this is relevant breaking news for you. Amen.